A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 9, Their Finest Hour, Artemisium and Thermopylae, Part 1.
Sometime about 485, Sparta consulted the Delphic Oracle once again, this time about upcoming events, and received the disturbing news that, so far as hostilities with Persia were concerned, Sparta would either have a king die in battle, which so far as we know had not happened up to that point to Sparta, or Sparta would be destroyed. And there was reason to be upset on other grounds. They were worried about the impiety of having executed the Spartan herald, rather the Persian heralds who had asked for earth and water years before. They felt that they were perhaps suffering from some kind of ritual pollution, and according to Herodotus, asked for volunteers to go to Xerxes, to offer to let Xerxes execute them in expiation, and indeed, two volunteers, both very prominent high-level Spartans, so we're told, did volunteer, by the names, as it happened, of Sperthius and Bulus, and they made their way to Xerxes, who was duly impressed, but told them, in Persia, we're not that impious ourselves. We're not that impious. We don't kill heralds. Go on home. So they did. But that does reveal how seriously the Spartans took, on one hand, the threat, on the other hand, the danger of impiety. Well, by 481, Persian preparations were far enough advanced that the relatively few Greek poleis, or polises, who felt compelled to resist the advance of Persia, and it was a distinct minority, decided they had better, for the moment at least, overcome their differences and offer a united front. And they formed what has been since called the Hellenic League in a meeting at the Isthmus of Corinth, a likely spot to meet for several reasons. Corinth was a prominent member, of course, probably other than Sparta, the most prominent member of the Peloponnesian League. Most of the polities that had refused to submit to Persia were, in fact, in the Peloponnese, led, of course, by Sparta herself, and the Peloponnese, the isthmus leading into the Peloponnese, in fact, seemed to many Peloponnesians in particular readily defensible. It's only 6 kilometers, about 4 miles wide, and the plan was to erect a wall and mount a defense right there, or at least one of the plans was to do so. The Hellenic League cast their nets as far as they could, seeking allies. They tried to persuade Gelon, the tyrant of Syracuse, in the island of Sicily, a Greek, to join them, and Gelon was very powerful character, and Syracuse a very powerful state. He consented to join if he could lead the expedition, or at least be half leader, and the rest of the alliance was unwilling to accede to those demands, which is probably just as well, because at the same time he was facing a massive threat from Carthage, whom he purportedly defeated on the very same day as the Battle of Salamis in a naval contest of essentially, or in a contest of essentially the same size and magnitude. They also tried to gain allies from Crete. Nope. From the island that we now know as Corfu, called in those days Corcyra. They said, yeah, maybe, and sent their fleet in the event to the southern tip of the Peloponnese, where they waited things out to see how it would go. But they did not, in fact, participate. Both Athens and Argos wanted to control the expedition, or at least to have joint control, Athens in particular, by sea. But the consensus of the League was that they wanted the Spartans in charge of things, and appointed to command the fleet was a Spartan by the name of Eurybiades, and appointed to command at least at Thermopylae on land was the Spartan king Leonidas. The defense at Thermopylae and the concurrent defense at Artemisium at the northern end of the island of Euboea, which we've already spoken of, was not, in fact, the first attempt at defense which the Hellenic League made. Their first attempt was further north at what's called the Vale of Tempe in the valley of the Peneos River near Mount Olympus, further north in Greece. And early on in 480, as the troops of Xerxes were advancing under the leadership of the Spartan Euanidas and of the Athenian Themistocles, the alliance dispatched 10,000 hoplites, a lot, by sea to try to hold the line at Tempe, further north. When they got there, though, they realized that the position could be turned by a variety of passes, through which Xerxes did, in fact, proceed with his army, and so, wishing to avoid being flanked, they withdrew and thought the problem through once again. Xerxes' army was huge. Herodotus gives a figure which pretty much no one believes, of roughly 2.5 million troops, with another 2.5 million in support. Some modern authorities size things down to 80,000. I find that implausibly small myself. It was immense. If I had to guess, for what it's worth, and it's probably not worth much, I would guess somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 or thereabouts. Again, I think we tend to underestimate the sophistication and general extensiveness of the works of ancient civilizations. Be that as it may, it was huge. It was the biggest army anybody had ever seen, and Herodotus also gives the figure of 1,207 warships with various other ships, a good deal more of them as supply ships accompanying the expedition. The amphibious character and the necessarily amphibious character of the expedition is something that requires some emphasis. To feed under ancient conditions and ancient transportation conditions, an army of that side, even with pre-established supply dumps, is a really formidable undertaking. The logistics are very challenging indeed. And the plan throughout was for Xerxes' army to march around the shore of the Aegean with the fleet accompanying it. And the fleet had to accompany it. One reason why, Themistocles at least, and others thought that the planned defense at the Isthmus of Corinth line wouldn't work, was as long as Xerxes had a fleet in being, he could simply bypass the Isthmus of Corinth with his fleet and land troops somewhere else and then take the Isthmus line in a pincer movement, which meant that any Greek defense was going to have to confront, preferably simultaneously, both the Persian fleet and the Persian army, which is what the Greeks then, by August, had decided to do. August of the year 480, which means, by the way, that August of the year 2010 will be the 2500th anniversary, or of the year, actually, 2520 will be the 2500th anniversary of these events. 2510, the anniversary of Marathon. Astonishingly enough, in 480, the Greeks were holding the Olympics, even as the Persians advanced, seeking to conquer all of Hellas. Nevertheless, in Elis in the northwest Peloponnese at Olympia, the Olympic Games were in progress. And not only that, as usual, the Spartans were celebrating the Carnia and were hesitant to detach more folks than they had to. Nevertheless, by about the third week in August of 480, the Greeks had taken up what they assumed would be their most favorable forward positions. Since Athens was resisting Persia, and Athens lay on the non-Peloponnesian side of the Isthmus of Corinth, the Athenians were understandably eager to have at least some major defense mounted before Attica got invaded, just to withdraw and leave Athens itself to the mercy of the Persians was not at first thought something that very much appealed to the Athenians. For those and other reasons, they decided to mount this defense in advance of the homelands of the majority of the resisting states at Thermopylae on one hand and at Artemision on the other. Thermopylae, as it happens, is almost due north of Delphi. It's northwest of Athens in the Melian Gulf, as it's called, which extends westward from the north part of the island of Euboea. Artemision is on the north part of Euboea itself, where there was a temple to Artemis, hence the name Artemision. They decided that their best bet would be to mount a defense there. The Persian fleet was going to have to go around Euboea one way or another, on the inland side or on the Aegean outside. The inland side at one point gets very, very narrow indeed, way less, way, way less than a mile. They thought that this would work to their advantage, and by placing the fleet at Artemision, they would be in position to deal with the Persians whichever way they decided to proceed. Thermopylae was chosen very, very carefully as well. The site now is well inland from the Melian Gulf. That was not true in ancient times. There have been a lot of estuarian deposits in the meanwhile, which have assured that the shoreline is distant from the actual point which the Greeks defended. At that point, Thermopylae, there were hot springs there, hence the name Thermopylae, which means hot gates, was at its narrowest a track maybe 50 feet wide, 20 meters wide max, maybe a little less than that. We're told that it was sufficient that two wagons could pass each other barely, with on the one hand the sea and on the other hand relatively sheer, not really cliff-like, but steep mountain walls. Thus it was a choke point. And if, as they did, the Persians wanted to get further south to Athens, to the Peloponnese, they were going to have to go through Thermopylae, and that would be a good place to resist them, in large part because the narrowness of the pass would assure that, A, Persian cavalry would not be useful. It was too steep on the one side and, of course, ocean on the other, and B, only a limited number of Persians could engage at any given time. Accordingly, in the third week of August, a Greek detachment was sent to hold that pass. There are a lot of complexities here. Purportedly, with the Carnia, at least when they were detached, still going on, the group which was sent to Thermopylae was an advance force, with more coming, and the idea being that the Hellenic alliance would mount a real thoroughgoing defense at Thermopylae. That's one side of it. On the other side of it, Leonidas led a carefully picked group of precisely 300 full Spartans, with Helot retainers and others, but 300 full Spartans. No accident, precisely the number of the traditional royal bodyguard of the Hippies, as they were called, who were young men in the early age groups. These guys, however, were not. These were all men deliberately picked who had sons who were alive. That in itself suggests that right from the outset, the Spartans conceived it in some sense as a suicide mission. So too do the reported final words of Leonidas to his wife Gorgo as he departed. He, again, her half-uncle, somewhere about 25 years older than she, both in the royal family by birth as well as by marriage, and his parting shot to her when she asked for advice was, we are told, marry a good man and bear good children, which does not sound like the advice of a man who expects to be coming home again. If that's the case, though, the question becomes, what exactly did they think they were doing? As the Spartans, originally a more considerable contingent, about 4,000 total, advanced on Thermopylae to face an army which at the absolute minimum outnumbered them 20-1, if not 50-1, if not thousands to one. What did they think they were doing? Well, one answer to that question, it may be, is provided by the oracle which the Spartans had received some years before, suggesting that either a king of Sparta must die in battle or Sparta would be defeated, and Sparta would not have been eager to have either of those events transpire, but there's little question if it came to that which they would have preferred, And Herodotus thinks, and I suspect too, that part of what Leonidas was up to was to send himself off there to die in order to deflect from Sparta the prophesied total destruction. In any case, they set up shop in the pass of Thermopylae and waited. And at this point, the account of Herodotus gets very interesting. We are told that Xerxes could not believe that this tiny force seriously attempted to resist them. So he asked in his entourage, the former king Demaratus, who you will remember from previous lectures, what's going on? Will these people really fight me, outnumbered as they are? To which Demaratus, according to Herodotus, replies, Sire, since you insist that I speak the truth and say nothing for which you could later accuse me of falsehood, here it is. In Hellas, poverty is always and forever a native resident, while excellence is something acquired through intelligence and the force of strict law. It's through the exercise of this excellence that Hellas wards off both poverty and despotism. Now, while I commend all the Hellenes who live in the Dorian lands, what I shall tell you next applies not to all of them, but only to the Lacedaemonians. First of all, there is no way that they will accept your stated intention to enslave Hellas. Next, even if all the other Hellenes come to see things your way, the Spartans will certainly oppose you in battle. And you need not ask as to their number in order to consider how they could possibly do this, for if there are 1,000 of them marching out, they will fight you, and if they number more or less than that, it makes no difference. They will fight you all the same. Xerxes doesn't believe it. How could 1,000 or even 10,000 or 50,000 men, all of them alike being free and lacking one man to rule over them, stand up to an army as great as mine, even if there are 5,000 of them, will outnumber them more than 1,000 to 1? To which, famously, Demaratus replies, the Lacedaemonians are no worse than other men when they fight individually, but when they unite and fight together, they are the best warriors of all. For though they are free, they're not free in all respects, for they're actually ruled by a lord and master. Law is their master, and it's the law that they inwardly fear, much more so than your men fear you. They do whatever it commands, which is always the same. It forbids them to flee from battle. And no matter how many men they're fighting, it orders them to remain in their rank and either prevail or perish. As Demaratus puts it, and Herodotus puts it, in defense of their freedom and of the freedom of the Greeks. Well, Xerxes still doesn't believe it, and so he sends a scout to see what the Lacedaemonians and their allies are doing as they wait for Xerxes to come in close and engage. And what the scout sees, Herodotus describes in the following terms. It just so happened that at that moment the Lacedaemonians were posted outside the main pass, and the scout saw some of these men exercising and others combing their hair, which astonished him. After he'd ascertained their number and every other detail, he rode back undisturbed, for no one pursued him. In fact, he was practically ignored. When he returned, he reported all that he had seen to Xerxes. Again, then, he sends to Demaratus to explain. And Demaratus says, you heard what I said about these men before. when we were just setting out against Hellas, and you made me a laughingstock when you heard my view of how these matters would turn out. But it's my greatest goal to tell you the truth in your presence, so hear me now. These men have come to fight us for control of the road. That's really what they're preparing to do, for it's their tradition that they groom their hair whenever they're about to put their lives in danger. But now know this. If you subjugate these men and those who've remained behind in Sparta, there is no other race of human beings that'll be left to raise their hands against you. For you are now attacking the most noble kingdom of all the Hellenes, and the best of men. Xerxes waits for a few days and then, losing patience, decides to attempt to force the pass. And he sends strong troops in to begin with, and ultimately his strongest troops, the so-called 10,000 immortals, the Greeks imagined that they were so-called because once any one of them died or was killed, he was immediately replaced. So the number always stayed at 10,000, and nobody for 2 days makes much headway. Indeed, the Spartans in particular are so well trained that they cause a lot of casualties by feigned retreats. They would fight in a forward line, then pretend to be broken, run back with a great deal of whooping and hollering. According to Herodotus, the folks they were fighting against would follow them, and then on cue, the Spartans would turn and come back and attack them while they were in disorder, and the casualties mounted and mounted and mounted, and Xerxes grew more and more frustrated. It wasn't only Spartans who were there, though Spartans, unsurprisingly, according to Herodotus, demonstrated far and away the most skill. There were also various more or less local forces and some people from Thespians, as they were called, in Boeotia, and some people from Thebes, also in Boeotia, in these forces. But the Spartans seems to have taken the leadership role, and although there were some casualties on the Greek side, the casualties on the Persian side were orders of magnitude, at least an order of magnitude greater, and Xerxes was not making much headway at all, even though mounted above, he was watching the battle as it progressed. At that point, a local who Herodotus is at pains to record for the sake of assuring his enduring ignominy, a fellow by the name of Ephialtes, tells Xerxes about a pass through the mountains, a relatively difficult pass by which he can get behind the position at Thermopylae and box the defenders. The pass is called the Anopeia. Leonidas knew about it, and on the theory that their lands were most directly threatened by the Persians, had put the local detachment of Phocians or Phocians to guard that pass. Well, after 2 days of fighting, Xerxes sends off his 10,000, his immortals, on a night march over the Anopeia. And about midway through it, according to Herodotus, they're rustling fallen oak leaves, and the sound alerts the Phocians. They attack the Phocians, and the Phocians withdraw to prepare themselves to withstand an attack from the immortals. But the immortals instead, after driving them away from the path itself, just walk on by. And by the time dawn comes, the immortals are behind the position which the Spartans are defending. At this point, and there's some dispute about this, either most of the folks who are defending the past took advantage of their few remaining moments for potential escape and departed, or, I think more likely, Leonidas sent them off. That's the standard account, and that, I suspect, is what really happened. The only folks who stayed were the Spartans, the Thespians, and some Thebans who were in an odd position. According to Herodotus, Thebes really was by and large in favor of Persia, and these were the Thebans who disagreed. Certainly, Thebes did later Medes and paid the price for it in bad reputation for many years to come. But whatever the truth, there were Thebans there as well when the final stand took place. Leonidas purportedly told his troops to have a good breakfast because that for dinner that night they'd be dining with Hades. And when the time came, they fought to the last man. All killed. Supposedly, they fought so fiercely that after a while, having had enough even of these folks fighting with broken weapons and fingernails and teeth, they just withdrew and buried them with arrows until there was nobody left alive. And Xerxes was so frustrated that, to some degree contrary to Persian custom, he mutilated the body of Leonidas when he figured out which of the bodies was Leonidas. The story goes, and this is evidently true, that there were two of the Spartan contingent of 300 who were at that point suffering from eye infections, which made them effectively blind. And Leonidas ordered them both home, since he didn't think they could fight very well under the circumstances being blind. One of them ordered his helot to bring him to the line and died fighting, and the other one did indeed go home, where he was so thoroughly disgraced that he fought with suicidal abandon the next year, because his life as a known trembler or trezante had become impossible to him. The Spartans were impressed, but not that impressed. They didn't really like suicidal fighting. They liked self-controlled fighting, and he was doing a little bit too much. But in any case, Xerxes succeeded, finally, in forcing the pass. What he did not succeed in doing, and this, I suspect, was in some sense the point all along, was intimidating the Greeks or breaking the Greeks' spirit. Indeed, the Greeks were energized after Thermopylae, and Xerxes was disheartened. Clearly, these Hellenes, Spartans in particular, but Hellenes in general, were a lot more formidable than anybody he had ever encountered before, and dealing with them, even with huge odds in his own favor, was no laughing matter. On the other hand, the Greeks thought, we can fight these guys. We did very well. We lost, but we did very, very well. And in some sense, the sacrifice of Leonidas at Thermopylae enlivened the Greeks, encouraged the Greeks, crystallized Greek resolve to make good the rest of the defense against Persia. It was, in some sense, a willing Spartan sacrifice on behalf not just of Sparta, but of Greece as a whole, and it was certainly the Spartans' finest hour, and to the extent that the Spartans have gained the admiration of posterity, it was here, above all, that they gained it. The epitaphs at the time suggest as much, and they are in their own way very moving. Here's one. 3 million foes were once fought right here by 4,000 men from the Peloponnese. And then probably the most famous epitaph of all time for the 300, composed purportedly by the poet Simonides, "Go tell the Spartans, stranger passing by, that here, obedient to their laws, we lie." You can still go. It's still there. You can still see it. The bravest of the Spartans after the battle was reportedly a fellow by the name of Dionysus, who Stephen Pressfield makes the hero of his own novelization of the battle, Gates of Fire. Herodotus attributes to Dionysus one of the most famous of laconic comments. He is told by a Trachinian friend that the Persians are so many that when they shoot their arrows, it darkens the sun. To which we are told, Dionysus replied, "All the better, my friend. We'll fight in the shade." And so they did.
This ends Lecture 9.